Welcome to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Whistleblowing is the term used when a public employee with knowledge of certain improper or illegal activities conducted by a public agency makes those activities publicly known. That act can sometimes result in severe repercussions to the public employee when speaking out on a highly political issue. The art of anonymous activism, serving the public while surviving public service, is a short book published by three public interest organizations based in Washington, D.C. Those organizations, POGO, the Project on Governmental Oversight, www.pogo.org, and GAP, the Government Accountability Project, www.whistleblower.org, and PEER, P-E-E-R, Public Employees for Environmental Responsibility, www.peer.org, are publishers of The Art of Anonymous Activism. Jeff Rook is the executive director of PEER and the co-editor of The Art of Anonymous Activism. I spoke with him recently by phone from his office in Washington, D.C., and I asked him to tell us about The Art of Anonymous Activism.
It's a guide for employees who are encountering problems on the job as to how to proceed, about beginning to think about the question of whether or not to become, quote-unquote, a whistleblower, what their rights and options are. The subtitle of the book is Serving the Public While Surviving Public Service, and that sort of sums it up.
When you say problems on the job, what kind of problems do you mean?
We're working in environmental agencies like EPA and the Fish and Wildlife Service, and a lot of times the type of decisions these agencies makes are highly political. There's an awful lot of outside pressure on the agency. And when the agency is pressured to do the wrong thing and the employees in turn are pressured to go along, they're often faced with the dilemma of whether they're on one hand supposed to follow the law or on the other hand do what's good for their career. And that is what we basically kind of call the peer dilemma.
And then they're stuck with what to do, and this book walks them through some of the problems, some of the suggestions.
Yes, it gives a lot of case examples of people that have followed certain paths and what happened to them. One of the initial steps that we try to urge people to do, and it's sometimes very difficult because by the time they realize they have a problem, in many cases, they've already elevated it through the chain of command. The first impulse for a person is to solve the problem on the job, and that's a natural, healthy impulse. And when the problem isn't immediately solved, the impulse says, well, just elevate it further. Usually the people that are raising these concerns are the people that are the internal agency experts. They're the ones that have spent their time in the particular discipline, which is why they care so much about it and also are so aware of the consequences of doing it wrong. But in many cases, by elevating it up through the agency chain of command, in fact, they're sort of descending into their own kind of professional Dante personnel inferno. And by the time they realize that the agency considers them a problem, it's often kind of too late, in the sense of they've already been marked as a whistleblower, even though they never intended to be a whistleblower.
Can you give us some examples?
Sure, of employees that have elevated problems.
Right. And people who have tried to do good and not realizing they're digging their own grave.
Boy, I can think of an awful lot of examples from an awful lot of disciplines. Agency internal auditors that find problems that are internally embarrassing, that try to get top management to realize how serious the situation is, and management's response is to cover up, and part of that cover-up strategy is to discredit the auditors. Law enforcement officers who are doing too good a job on sensitive investigations sometimes find their careers in jeopardy because they're pursuing investigations too diligently. The typical example we run into is an agency biologist or other natural resource specialist who makes a recommendation that complicates a politically wired project. And so their evaluation is viewed as a roadblock, and in order to remove the roadblock, that person has to be removed. In none of these cases were these people consider themselves whistleblowers. They're merely doing their jobs. But because of they're not doing their jobs completely in tune with the directions the political winds are blowing, they often find themselves deemed institutionally inconvenient by their agencies, and in their minds, they were just trying to do the best job they could.
In your book, you talk about people who sin in an ecclesiastical sense versus people who blow the whistle in a political sense, and point out that perhaps God would forgive the sinners, but the bureaucracy never would forgive the whistleblower.
It's a quote from Admiral Hyman Rickover, who was the father of the nuclear navy, somebody who knew a thing or two about bureaucracies. And he said, "If you must sin, sin against God and not the bureaucracy. For God may forgive your sins, but the bureaucracy never will." And the purpose of the quote is to illustrate that when an employee goes public and blows the whistle on his agency, there's no, as we say, there's no going back to Kansas anymore. Your career path is forever altered, and we try to make sure that when employees take that step, they do so with full information and awareness that it's never going to be the same again.
What kind of counseling or legal advice do you provide to employees who may choose to do that?
In many instances, we're talking them out of blowing the whistle and trying to get them to think through exactly what they're trying to accomplish.
What the final goal is.
What the final goal is, and to separate out whatever the personnel concerns are from the policy or the issue. The problem with pursuing whistleblower litigation, as we point out, is that even if the employee wins, and in many cases what they're fighting is improper termination or transfer or something like that, even if they win, they only win a personnel victory in that they may be restored back to a job in an even more hostile agency or the transfer may be rescinded. But the court there in front of doesn't have any jurisdiction to address the underlying dysfunction for which the person was willing to risk their career in the first place. So if you can get an employee to concentrate on the issue and separate it so that the battle, as we say, is not taking place inside your personnel jacket, that's a much more productive way to go. The reason we talk about anonymous activism is that in many instances, if the information about what's going on inside the agency can make it into the public domain without the employee's fingerprints on it, the information will embarrass the agency into doing the right thing, at least temporarily. And if you can set up a system through organizing employees where that sort of disclosure takes place routinely, after a while the agency is kind of forced into doing the right thing as a matter of course, and after a while you dare call it reform. So that if you can concentrate on the issue and not the personnel track, you have sort of a double advantage in that you are addressing the underlying issue, and at the same time, the conscientious employees who are willing to take these risks remain inside the agency, are not ostracized or martyred, and can continue on with a normal or perhaps even an enhanced career path.
I think the key in what you just said is organizing the employees. How do you do that?
Well, sometimes it's not easy. We often liken the idea of organizing civil servants to kind of herding cats. It's sort of an oxymoronic enterprise. But the key is to find enough like-minded individuals who are concerned about the same things, who are willing to take concerted action. And we're not talking about organizing in the labor union sense, though we do an awful lot of work in conjunction with labor unions. It's a matter of getting mainly a small cadre, if you will, of employees who are concerned about an issue to work together to plan a campaign. We often say at Peer that the employees are the brains and we're the stationery. They're the ones that know where the bodies are buried. They know the issue. They know how the agency is going to react. And if you put at their disposal lawyers, public relations experts, stationery, sort of the apparatus of an organization, and let them laser guide the operation, we find that it's incredibly effective and efficient. And it also works well in conjunction with other mainstream citizen groups. And so that's what we're talking about doing. In many instances where the employees have accomplished their goals, as far as we're concerned, they should go out and have a beer and get on with their lives. It's not like we're trying to make people into professional or perpetual troublemakers. It's to give them a safe avenue in their own time to address the issues that are otherwise eating them up inside.
So you're saying let PEER, the group of which you're the executive director, laser guide the issues?
No, the employees laser guide it, and they simply use us as the instrument. They know how to redeploy the information and what information can be safely redeployed into the public domain in a way that will produce the right effects. So that's why we say they're the brains and we're just the stationery.
I'd like to take a moment and say that this week we're talking with Jeff Rook, the executive director of a Washington, D.C. group called PEER, Public Employees for Environmental Responsibility. And Jeff is one of the co-editors of a recent book called The Art of Anonymous Activism, Serving the Public While Surviving Public Service. You're listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Jeff, tell us about PEER, Public Employees for Environmental Responsibility, and what your group seeks to do.
We were founded by public employees who were facing the dilemma that I talked about earlier of being pressured on the job to look the other way or not implement the law or in some cases to violate the law. And most of our staff and our board consist of public employees that have left public service because they were frustrated with these kind of pressures and are using the organization as a way to address it. And so what we are is we're a service organization for people that work inside of land management, pollution control, wildlife protection agencies. And the service we provide them is to help them address the environmental issues they feel are not being addressed in their day jobs. We have 10 offices around the country that, as I said, are run by former public employees who have been through this kind of experience themselves. We have members in all 50 states, and at the moment, and certainly at the federal level with the Bush administration, it's certainly a growth field.
The kind of experience you refer to as being required to do something that they know is inappropriate.
Yes.
If someone wants to contact PEER, how do they do that?
Well, a couple ways. Our website is www.peer.org.
Jeff, in looking at your book, it's pretty clear that this publication is for public information. You're not seeking a revenue stream from it. So can you give us a lot of the details of the book and
sure.
perhaps some examples?
Sure. The thrust of what we're saying is that if you have a choice, it's far more effective to deliver the message and not the messenger. The agency would love to be able to talk about a particular disgruntled employee and change the subject, if you will. But in many instances, when there's a revelation of misconduct about the agency, the source of the information doesn't matter, and the source of the information is used to divert attention away from the underlying problem. Let me give you an example. About a year ago, in the midst of the debate in Congress about drilling at the Arctic National Refuge, we were contacted by Fish and Wildlife Service employees that indicated that Secretary of Interior Gail Norton had, in essence, falsified the material that had been supplied to her office by the Fish and Wildlife Service and was misinforming Congress, contrary to representations that she would do her best to reflect only the best science, quote-unquote. So these employees helped us to assemble the paper trail of information that went into her office, and we were also able to obtain the information that came out of her office, and did a line-by-line comparison and found that she had made 17 significant changes. This is displayed on our website. So we went public with that. It was actually the day that she was the keynote speaker at the Society of Environmental Journalists. You can imagine that it caused quite a stir and was the major focus of the questions that she received from the audience. And it did an awful lot to embarrass the administration at a key point in the debate. The point of this in terms of the message versus the messenger is the source of that information was never known. All of the sources were have continued their career in the Fish and Wildlife Service undisturbed. Where that information came from is irrelevant to what the message was, which was that the secretary was lying to Congress. So that's an example of how this sort of technique can work and accomplish what the employees want to, which was to expose something that was going on inside the agency, but again, with them not being blown up in the process.
So what you're saying is that she either knew she was lying, the Secretary of the Interior knew, or she should have known.
Yes.
Do you know which it was?
We think that she knew, though she blamed it on anonymous staff within the agency, and at one point, for one particularly glaring change, said it was a typographical error.
What was the result of that, other than the public chagrin and embarrassment of the Secretary of the Interior?
Well, it was a major contributor to the, in our view, the Senate vote that, at least for now, blocked the administration from going forward with their plans.
That's the drilling of oil in the Arctic National Wildlife Zone.
Right, right. In a larger sense, it also, I think, communicated to the Secretary's office that she was being watched by the people that were most knowledgeable about her activities from within. And we think that's a useful message.
Are there some other examples, some other case studies that you can tell us about?
Sure. An example of somebody going public in a way that didn't make them the focus is an Army Corps of Engineers economist named Dr. Donald Sweeney, who was in charge of the economic studies to determine whether or not it made sense to do major reconstruction of all the locks and dams on the upper Mississippi River and Illinois waterway. This is a civil works project that's second in size only to the Everglades restoration. He worked with his colleagues both inside and outside of the Corps to develop what was a reliable, plausible model. And once he got a sign-off on that, did the runs on the model, and it seemed to indicate that this project wasn't justified in this generation. And that was not the answer the Corps of Engineers management wanted to hear. So he was pressured to change the numbers, and when he refused, he was removed from the project. After he was removed, a number of his colleagues provided him information about what had been done by the commanders in the Corps to directly change numbers, or I think the parlance is cook the books. So when Dr. Sweeney came forward through us, while his identity was known, he made the focus not what had happened to his career, but what had been done to cook the books. He made a disclosure rather than a complaint that triggered investigations of the Corps, not of him. The result was that the Corps was exposed. Two top generals, commanders in the Corps, were disciplined and have retired, as well as a colonel. And the topic of Corps reform has become a major issue in the halls of Congress, such a big issue that the Corps' biannual authorization of new projects was blocked this past year because the Corps refused to accept the reform proposals that had emanated out of the Sweeney case. Dr. Sweeney is now on a transfer and is now will serve out his career at the University of Missouri, St. Louis, in the Institute of Transportation Studies. And he, in our view, is an example of somebody who, even though they went public in a way that kept the focus on the message and not so much on his identity or whether or not he was a good or diligent employee, though there wasn't any question about whether he was good or diligent.
What do you propose for people who are aware of environmental problems and the failure of government agencies to follow the rules but don't work within the system?
By don't work within the system...
Are not government employees.
Oh, if... there are a number of organizations that are working on the issue, and so they should get involved with those organizations and contribute what they know. In many instances, we need partnership with those kind of concerned organizations because our sole role is this service to the employees, and so we're often looking for mainstream partners to make sure that when the information gets out that it resounds in the right places in the right way with the sufficient intensity to accomplish what the sources wanted to accomplish.
Can you tell us about some of those partner organizations?
Sure. For example, in the Army Corps of Engineers case, we work with Environmental Defense and Taxpayers for Common Sense, a mainstream environmental organization, Environmental Defense, and a taxpayers protection group, Taxpayers for Common Sense. In many of our state campaigns, we're working with the local Sierra Clubs, and the Sierra Club state offices in many states are the best or the only resource that is going. So it depends. We're working, for example, right now with a group called the Western Land Exchange Project on behalf of BLM land appraisers who have exposed what are supposed to be equal trades that have cost the U.S. Treasury hundreds of millions of dollars.
How does the existing law protect either the whistleblower or the people who are not employees but seek to blow the whistle on what the problem is?
Well, there are sort of two dimensions. One is the law in theory, and the other is the law in practice. For those that aren't inside the agency, there should be no issue, and it's not clear how they would be constrained or why they'd need to resort to legal measures because their activities are protected by free speech, and they're generally not in a position where the people they're talking about are in a position to retaliate. For those employees that work within the agencies, harkening back to Admiral Rickover's quote, they face some genuine career risks that shouldn't be ignored. And in theory, they're protected by the First Amendment on the job because they work for the government, whereas you and I don't work for the government. And there are an array of whistleblower laws that, in theory, say that you shouldn't be suffering any kind of negative career consequence for reporting wrongdoing. The problem is invoking these laws or enforcing them, and in many instances, they can only be invoked after something bad has been done to you. So it's almost like we liken it in the book to a Volkswagen going through the intersection with a right-of-way but are hit pell-mell illegally by a Mack truck. The Volkswagen, the employee, has the right-of-way, but they've still been run over by a truck. So generally you have to wait until some damage has been occurred, and then you try to use these laws to make yourself whole. And as I discussed earlier, even in theory, even when you win, as a practical matter, it's never going to be the same again. And so while we work to enforce these laws and to make them stronger, we also try and be realistic and counsel people to resort to these routes only as a last resort.
The other resorts prior to blowing the whistle would be?
Well, we advise them to contact groups like ours to work to make sure that the information can get out. A good example is almost daily we're contacted by employees that say such and such a document should see the light of day. So we, in essence, have them draft for us a Freedom of Information Act request, which we then send to the agency to extract the information.
And they draft the document because they know the specifics of what you should look for.
Right. In many instances, they'll provide us with a copy of it, but still we'll want to go through the front door to make the agency cough it up publicly. Sometimes just that transaction where the agency is forced to publicly disclose the document is enough to accomplish what the employee wants. Because generally speaking, what the employees that we talk to are concerned about are decisions that are reached behind closed doors, not the publicly debated policy changes that are discussed in state legislatures or the halls of Congress. It's really, despite the rhetoric of we're doing our best to enforce the laws, the reality that's going on inside the agency is that in many instances, because of pressure, they're subverting the law or doing their best to avoid enforcing it. And those are the kind of problems the employees are trying to expose.
And that pressure is often the political pressure from the people who would be able to benefit financially by not following the law.
That's the ultimate source of it. Depending upon how the state or the agency is configured, In many instances, the person that's been appointed to head the agency is a former lobbyist or corporate lawyer for the regulated industry. So you're in an agency where the fox isn't just guarding the hen house, the fox is running the hen house. And so those kind of situations, the pressure can be immediate and direct. In other instances, the pressure may be coming from a legislative body where a unit of an agency is doing a particularly good job and the legislative opponents, funded with generous corporate campaign contributions, will do something like defund the unit, take away their funding, or do a legislative reorganization that scatters the unit to the winds. So it depends upon what's going on, but usually the ultimate source of the pressure is the industry that would benefit from not complying with the law.
Well, Jeff Rook, Executive Director of Public Employees for Environmental Responsibility, thank you for joining us on Radio Curious. And before we close, I'd like to ask you to tell us about an interesting book that you've read lately.
Well, it was actually, I was going to point you to a report that's on our website. It's actually two reports. One is the final report, and the other is the draft report. It's by EPA, and it's kind of ponderous. It's called Used or Fixed Munitions and Unexploded Ordnance at Closed, Transferred, and Transferring Military Ranges. And it's, as I said, on our website under News. And what I found fascinating was, because it was such a clear example of a draft report that was written by the agency experts and then what was taken out of the draft under political pressure by the Pentagon. And the comparison, we have a separate 20-page document that shows you all the excised portions, to me are sort of a classic illustration of how this pressure gets executed inside an agency.
Jeff Rook, thank you very much for joining us on Radio Curious.
Thank you for having me.
Jeff Rook is the co-editor of The Art of Anonymous Activism, Serving the Public While Surviving Public Service. He is also the executive director of PEER, Public Employees for Environmental Responsibility. The readings he recommends are two Environmental Protection Agency reports that show the difference between a draft report written by EPA agency experts and what was taken out of the final report due to pressure from the Pentagon. Those two reports may be found on the PEER website, www.peer.org, under the News heading. Copies of this and other editions of Radio Curious are available for $10 each. I'll give you the address in just a moment. At Radio Curious, we appreciate your cards, letters, suggestions, and ideas for future programs. And here's the address. Radio Curious, Post Office Box 7, Ukiah, that's UKIAH, California, 95482. The phone is 707-462-6541, and the email is curious@pacific.net. You've been listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Stay curious, be creative, and join us again next week.